All right, thanks, Dave. Well, we're going to continue our study in Matthew. So if you have a Bible, I'd encourage you to bring them out at this time. And let's turn together to Matthew chapter 17. Matthew 17. While you're turning there, just want to give you one additional bit of information, sort of an update. You know, it's been several months back, we told you that with this new sanctuary setup, and it's still relatively new to us, that we wanted to maintain this in terms of this setup as, the old way, we were kind of sideways, and the acoustics were hard, they were tough, they were always a fight and a struggle, and it wasn't even the best utilization of space. I don't know if you realize it, but by turning the sanctuary around like this, we have 98 extra chairs on the floor right now than we had prior to doing this. And so part of the vision behind it was, my goodness, we're all coming out of COVID. Half the people were in one of two services beforehand, and now that things are getting back together, who's in? Who's apart? Where are they? Who moved? And we just thought, well, it'd be great if we can get everybody in together for as long as possible. And there may come a day where God will say, I'm going to bless you to the degree that you can't all meet at once and you have to expand. And when that happens, well, we'll deal with it. But until then, we thought, boy, wouldn't it be great if we can just all continue to remain together. So God has really helped us on that. Now, you've seen some changes. The soundboard has moved. We got it towards the back rather than it being the first thing that you encounter when you walk in. We still have some things to do back here with the staging. And we've been talking to different builders and trying to get different ideas and cost estimates of what does that mean, what would that look like, and we're still working through it. But we appreciate your patience as we do so. And in the meantime, of course, you have other ideas. We always welcome any ideas that you might bring. That doesn't guarantee that we can take on the idea, but it does mean sometimes it can really help us or give us something that would be of benefit to us. So don't hesitate to do that with myself, with the staff, with any of the elders. So more changes to come, but it'll be more cleaning up, if you will. So, all right, well, Matthew 17. Let's start out first, just a little story. The very first squadron that I was a part of in the Navy, I walked in and it was my rude awakening. I thought I just got to go in and be a pilot. No, not so fast. You get to be a pilot, but you have another job, too, that you have to be a part of and take on. And my first one that was assigned was the public affairs office. And so my job was to make sure that our squadron made it into the base newspaper, that people learned about promotions, that, you know, anything I could do that put our squadron in a good light, that was my job. You be looking out for those opportunities. Well, one opportunity I wasn't looking out for but came my way was when my skipper, the commanding officer, called me into his office and he said, okay, Jack, here's the deal. We have this new campaign that's coming up. We have it every year. And it's a matter in which we go to the people in our congregation and say, we want you to donate to a particular charity. And you're going to take part of your paycheck and allocate it towards that charity. And I thought, well, that's interesting. And so we're like, well, Skipper, I already do that. I do that every week with my church. And every week, my wife and I, we set aside a percentage and we're given faithfully every paycheck towards that church. So we already have this. And he said, well, you don't understand. This is a drive that makes us all look good, and it gets our people to thinking beyond themselves. And so I want 100% participation, you going to every single person, and they don't have to give much, but they have to give. And they gave you this booklet, and it was a big, thick booklet of all the different charities that you could donate to. And so I'm looking at this thing, and I'm going, okay, I don't know about this. And the skipper goes one step further. He goes, by the way, I'm donating, and by the way, you're donating too, because you can't go to people and ask if they'll contribute to this if you yourself aren't doing so. So, you know, it's that classic voluntold to do something. And I'm looking at the different charities, and I'm like, you know, I don't know a lot of these charities. I don't know what they represent or what they stand for. I know for a fact I don't agree with some of them. And so, you know, am I really going to take part of my money and give it to the United Way, you know, whoever? And I was struggling with it. And so I went to a friend of mine who was a person in my church. He was a little bit more of a senior naval officer. And I told him about my dilemma. And he said, well, I hear what you're saying, but here's the deal, Jack. God's given you that man as your commanding officer. And he's not asking you to do anything immoral. You need to do it. So as I was praying about it, then the guy came up and said, by the way, I don't know if you realize this, but there are some Christian charitable organizations in that book. And as I began to open and go through it, sure enough, I found one. It was called the Navigators. And we were very familiar with the Navigators. I'd been ministered to by a lot of their ministries when I was in high school. And so we decided that's what we'll do. And we'll give part of our additional part of our paycheck, but at least we know it's going to something good that we can support. And now it's been, 32 years later, and we're still supporting the Navigators through a couple of missionaries that we've known over the years and providing help and support to them. Well, the incident brought up the issue to me early on, though, in my Christian life. What do you do when an authority calls upon you to do something, and it's either contrary to something you would choose, and I'm not talking about something immoral, all right? It's just not something you would choose to do, and on your own, but as an act of submission, you're called to do it. Well, in Matthew 17, we go there to see what Jesus did when he faced this. Now, you've all heard the phrase, in this world, nothing is certain but death and taxes. And the end of chapter 17 covers both. We saw last week death. Jesus spoke about his death. But then we learned, actually, it really wasn't so much about his death as much as it was getting us ready for his resurrection. Well, the text that we're looking at in just a few verses we've got are going to talk about taxes, but really, it's not talking about taxes. It's going to talk about humility, and humility in how you deal with authorities in your life. Jesus is still walking his band of men through his school of discipleship. In today's lesson, they're given this prerequisite course towards everything that they're going to need to fully appreciate, understand, and to live out that we're going to discover in chapter 18. The prerequisite is humility, and this is a big lesson in it. Now, we have a saying in Texas that goes like this, never dig up more snakes than you can kill. Today's four little verses has the potential to dig a big hole and get a lot of snakes coming out of it. In fact, a whole lot more than I'm comfortable with. But this text is here. And we need to deal with it. We need to come face to face and address it and wrestle with it. So let's start here in verse 24. Jesus is bringing his disciples together, and it says, when they came to Capernaum, those who collected the 2 drachma tax came to Peter and said, does your teacher not pay the 2 drachma tax? He said, yes. When he came into the house, Jesus spoke to him first, saying, what do you think, Simon? From whom do the kings of the earth collect customs or poll tax? From their sons? Or from strangers? And when Peter said, from strangers, Jesus said to him, then the sons are exempt. However, so that we do not offend them, go to the sea and throw in a hook and take the first fish that comes up, and when you open its mouth, you will find a shekel. Take that and give it to them for you and me. Fascinating story in just four little verses. Peter's here in his hometown. He's minding his own business, probably went to the local giant grocery store, and as he walks out, there's a table with those people that are ready to just start asking you for money. Only in this case, it's not going to be the Girl Scouts looking for funds for cookies. What he discovers is the Jewish tax man standing there, clipboard in hand, table in front of him. Now, keep in mind, these are not Roman federal taxes that we're talking about here. That's not what's occurring and what's being collected. Get Roman IRS out of your minds here. This was a tax instituted by God only for the Jew. All right? God taxed the Jew? Some of you might say, oh yeah. Yeah, he absolutely did so. And he did it all the way back in Moses' day. In fact, way back in Exodus chapter 30, we find this. The text tells us, there we go. Text tells us that the Lord also spoke to Moses, saying, when you take a census of the sons of Israel to number them, this is what everyone who is numbered shall give, half a shekel according to the shekel of the sanctuary as a contribution to the Lord. Everyone who is numbered from 20 years old and over shall give the contribution to the Lord. You shall take the atonement money from the sons of Israel and shall give it for the service of the tent of meeting. So we can just summarize this and call it the tabernacle tax. That's what God was doing, because things would wear out. Things needed to be updated. I mean, I was just talking about that for our own sanctuary and church, right? You've got to do certain things to keep things up. And so what God did is he wasn't going to say, we're going to do this on voluntary contributions. Not at all. He said, oh, you will pay. you are going to pony up some money here. And he established it there in Exodus 30. And it wasn't a one-time thing. You keep reading in Exodus, you get to chapter 38, God re-emphasizes it. And then you go several hundred years later when Nehemiah is working with the town of Jerusalem. He's building the walls and he's getting the temple reestablished. He reinstitutes the tax because it had gone by the wayside. And so that's why these gentlemen are asking for this tax here, Peter. And they ask in a pretty clever way. You know, it's one of those where your answer is you're going to be giving, right? Not this is an option. No, you will do it. You and the rabbi will be giving this year, won't you? How much do we put you down for? The usual 2 drachma amount? And so Peter hears all this. He's caught off guard, and he goes, yeah, of course. And they say, thanks. They take out the clipboard. They write it down. Peter, Jesus, 2 drachma tax. Okay, that's great. We'll be by to pick it up next Wednesday. Peter walks away. As he's going, you can just sort of imagine what's going through his head. The wheels are starting to turn. He goes, okay, great. I haven't contributed yet, and I don't have any money, but I just committed myself to this. And what's more, I committed Jesus to this also, and I don't think he has any money either. So what kind of a plight have I gotten into? So he's walking back, and he's thinking through the strategy. And let's be candid, it's probably the exact same one that you would. And that is when the stranger knocks on the door, you tell everybody, don't answer. You know, hi, be quiet. Because let's face it, the only people that are going to be knocking on the door are going to be the Mormons, the pest control sales guys, and in this case, the tax man. So it's sort of like, just stay away from the door. We don't want any of them. So when Peter shows up, Jesus sort of relieves him. He doesn't even have to go into this discussion. He initiates a conversation. And he says, okay, Simon, let me ask you a question. When the king send their people out to go and collect these taxes from their subjects, does he start with the prince, his son, and his subjects? Or does he go out to the people of the land, the folks that were actually be receiving the benefits of the tax? Which is it? Now, Jesus moves from this religious idea of taxation to the civil, and it's just in order to help it make it a little bit easier for us to understand. So for now, try to forget your Washington, D.C. American taxation system and way of thinking and principles. Because Jesus' illustration involves kings. Kings who have a sovereign authority. What they say goes. And in that day, the prince and the future king wasn't taxed. When the people paid their taxes, it came in. And now this gave not only a fund that supported the king and his family, but ideally, this would also support the things that the king was going to do to take care of the people in the land. So, you know, when they got to deal with snow removal, we got this tax money. It's going to go for that. We got to get road improved. We've got that. If we have to host other kings in the area in order to keep peace or to establish trade, we need some funds to be able to do that. So your taxes are going to go to this, but the king isn't going to go to the prince and say, and you have to pay for it. He says, no, they're exempt. So the answer to Jesus' question is, it's the people. It's not the king, it's not his son who's going to get taxed to provide for the king and his court and his services. Now, in doing that, Jesus does something. He implies something about himself that you just can't miss. What's the implication? He's the king. Or maybe we could say, he's the prince. Because the father has recognized, this is my son. And on 2 separate occasions, out loud, he has made that declaration, this is my son with whom I'm well pleased. So as a result, he's declaring what Matthew has been making the case all along for us in this book so far. If Jesus is the king, where's the kingdom? Well, he starts with, but let's remember, Jesus is definitely the king. And so from this point on, it just continues to say, you can't dismiss that fact. But then he takes it one step further and he says, now let's talk about the tabernacle. The tabernacle was something very important to the Jew. This is where worship happened. And here, where Jesus is making the insinuation, he is much more significant than the temple. That's why he doesn't have to pay the taxes. Because remember, what's the whole purpose of the temple? What would you do with the temple? Why is it necessary within the Jewish culture to have this? You have it because this is the place where God would dwell with his people. This is the place where God would come down and you would orient around the tabernacle and to be in his presence. At Christmas, remember one of the titles we call Jesus? We call him Emmanuel. Remember what Emmanuel means? God with us. It's the point Jesus is higher than the tabernacle. In fact, in John 1:14, one of the things we see there is we learn that Jesus, God has now dwelt, or the word can actually be translated tabernacled among us, meaning Jesus now inhabits and lives among us to put on display and to facilitate God himself in amongst his people. Now it's present with the people. And Jesus is greater than the temple. In fact, the temple, everything about it is just a shadow and an illustration of him and who he is. In the tabernacle, sacrifices get offered. In Jesus, the highest sacrifice is offered. In the tabernacle, God's meant to be present with his people. But in Jesus, God is present with his people in the human body. God himself in that human form, in that human person. So the tabernacle isn't more significant than Jesus. And that would have been hard for a Jew to grasp and to understand. But it's the truth. And it makes sense to us, right? I mean, just stop and think about it. If there's somebody in this world that you highly respect and admire, and maybe they're very famous, and you have the opportunity to do one of two things, you have a choice. You can go have lunch with them. A friend of yours has the opportunity to give you a chance to go have lunch with them, or you can just get a tour of their house, and they're not there. Which one are you going to take? Obviously, you're going to take the person. The only time you tour the house of someone is because they're dead. You know, you can't visit with them. Well, in this instance, in this situation, Jesus is saying, you got the real deal here. You don't have just the tabernacle. You have all that the tabernacle is pointing towards. And so Peter's here, and he's hearing all this, and he's going, great. And I just committed Jesus to paying this tax, and I'm committed to paying this tax, and we're exempt, and oh, now he's just going to let me have it. Well, I don't think that's at all what Jesus is trying to do with Peter and the point that he's trying to make. In fact, what he's doing here is he's doing two different things. The first thing is he's letting them know that the Messiah King is greater than the temple. And Jesus is that Messiah King. But the second one is that the King would, in humility, surrender his privileges. Wow. And the reason I can say that is because of how verse 27 goes. When you follow along and you look at that one, look at how it begins. Jesus is saying, however, even though Jesus is exempt from this tax, however, he says, so that we do not offend them, go get the money where I've placed it and pay it to them for you and for me. Now, it's a fascinating story how Peter gets the funds, isn't it? When you look at how this unfolds. First, Peter's got to go to a bank, and he's not going to the First Savings and Loan of Capernaum. He's going to the bank of the Sea of Galilee, and I don't mean a brick-and-mortar bank. I mean the literal bank, right, of the shoreline of the Sea of Galilee. And it's there he's told, I want you to go fish. Now, normally, a fisherman would fish with a big net because they're trying to catch as many as they can, and that makes the most sense. Jesus won't let him do that. He says, no, I want you to go break out that little Zebco rod and reel you had as a kid, and you're going to take a single hook, and you're going to cast it out there, one cast, and the fish that I want to attach to that is going to do so. You got to start by doing this. And it's all because Jesus got this little safe deposit box at the bottom of the lake, right? And the only teller that can access it is a fish, probably a goldfish. Right? Did you catch that? All right, I can keep going, I won't. So what happens? The fish goes, he picks up the withdrawal amount, and Peter's to get it from that one. Don't you know that had to be yet another pretty amazing moment for Peter to go, okay, wait a minute. The odds of me even catching a fish on just a hook, much less a fish that has a coin in it, much less a fish that has a coin with the exact amount that I need to pay for the tax for myself and for Jesus. Now, don't miss this. All right. Every single miracle that Jesus ever worked has a purpose behind it. And here is to indisputably show Peter that Jesus was king over all creation. Even a single fish would obey his desire. Do y'all remember a time, another time in the Bible, where a fish obeyed God? Yeah, it's in the book of Jonah. And this, there it says that the Lord appointed a great fish to swallow Jonah. He appointed him for the exact place and time to go take care of this matter. And he's done the same thing again here. Peter has to know, this Jesus is a pretty amazing guy. All of creation submits unto him. Even a tiny fish will do exactly what he wants at the point that he wants. And Peter's never to forget that. This is the all-powerful king that I am with. And yet this king will humbly submit to the authorities in his life. Jesus wasn't going to exercise his exemption and by doing so create this unnecessary offense and hurdle that might hinder the ability of the Jews and even the Jewish leaders for seeing him for who he is. Whoa. Anybody getting uncomfortable yet? Back in chapter 15, Jesus spoke to the Pharisees, and he called them out on their hypocrisy. And remember what the disciples said? They came to him and said, Jesus, do you know the Pharisees were offended by the things that you said back there? You remember at that point, Jesus wasn't concerned about that at all. Not one bit. And yet here, he's very concerned about that. What's the difference? Why is it okay for Jesus to offend a group of people in one area and to be concerned about not offending them in another area? And it's all because Jesus could discern between matters that were essential to his message and his mission and the things that were not essential to his message and his mission. Because remember, back in chapter 15, remember what the religious leaders are doing? He challenged them because they invalidated the heart of God's message by the hypocrisy in how they lived and in the things they were teaching. And Jesus, in love, stood up to that and said, no. We can't let that kind of error go out and infect and hurt so many people. I am going to speak out. And if that offends you, tough cookies. You know, that's just the way it's going to be. But here, he's going to willingly submit to a tax. And the authorities that receive that tax, the whole point is that his message wouldn't be undermined with them. It's an act of submitting to a God-established authority. And humility would have him surrender his rights, a freedom he had, so as not to place a hurdle for others, a hurdle that could work against his message. I like to try to take the big idea of a passage and put it in something very short and very concise. I couldn't do it this time. So bear with me on this little paragraph that I think summarizes everything we've seen in here. The Messiah King would humbly surrender his personal freedoms to submit to the authorities in his life. And this established an evangelistic credibility by removing unnecessary stumbling blocks for others. And the implication? A disciple will live in the same way. Did I just dig a big hole full of snakes? A whole lot of snakes could come out of this one. Here are some of the snakes. Some of you, when you hear that, you start immediately going to this scenario. Jack, are you saying that we should unquestionably and always submit even to an immoral or abusive authority? Well, friend, this text is not condoning that. Not at all. You're not meant to go there. No, you do not cook the books if your boss says, we got to change the numbers on the accounting here because it'll be better for investments and better for the company in the long term. We don't do that. We don't submit there. No. A wife will not submit to her husband, should not submit to her husband, if he brings out the 1040 IRS form and says, yeah, this isn't true, but I'm signing it, and I want you to also, because, hey, you're supposed to submit to me. No, you don't. No. For those who worked for Harvey Weinstein, no, they're not to submit to his advances, but they're to oppose them and even to blow the whistle on that kind of thing and speak out against it. But again, that's not the point Jesus is addressing here. Jesus is showing us that this Christ-like humility doesn't live merely for you to assert your own rights. That we're to live for something higher than that. The Spirit of God will at times have us take our liberties and actually surrender them so as not to put an unnecessary hurdle in front of somebody else regarding the gospel. The Apostle Paul put it like this. He said, you were called to freedom. Brethren, only do not turn your freedom into an opportunity for the flesh, but through love serve one another. Now, this one I can summarize in a much shorter statement, and I can put it like this. We are more important than me. We got to look at everything, at all that God is doing here. And that's how Jesus lived. And the call is, that's how we're to live as well. When I was in seminary, I'll give you an example of this, I had a friend who was going through seminary as well. And he had a personal conviction that it was okay for him to drink alcohol. He would have an occasional glass of wine or whatever with his meal. He knew what the scripture said about drunkenness. He did not get drunk. He did not encourage drunkenness. He encouraged moderation. But the call was never get drunk. But it's okay for him to drink alcohol. Well, the school had a policy. As long as you're a student here, you won't drink alcohol. What's he going to do? Well, you're infringing on my rights. I should be able to do whatever it is I want to do. That's not what he did. What he did was he said, you know what? If that's what y'all need, and if my giving this up promotes unity and oneness and doesn't generate divisiveness here, then you know what? I'll give it up. You know, it's only 4 years. I can do anything for 4 years. And he did. He surrendered it. Why? Because he knew we are more important than me. That I need to look at what does God want to do through us, not how am I going to establish and assert my rights. That's one snake. The second snake comes down to this. How do I know whether my issue is a hill in which I'm to die on or not? And folks, this is a matter. There's a lot of confusion on this because there's so many issues out there right now, right? Within the church at large. And there's a whole lot of people that don't want to offend anybody under any circumstances. And it's almost like they're saying we just need to acquiesce to anything. No, that's not true. Jesus is not saying that you yield at the expense of truth and the gospel. But rather, be wise. Be wise on whether or not your issue in your context affects the mission and the message of the gospel. In other words, is this about Jesus or is this about you? Which is it? Now, this is one where I'll probably get emails afterwards, but I'm gonna share it anyway. And if I don't answer your email, well, I don't know what to think. Maybe just call me. During COVID, my son and his wife attend a church in the Boston area. And they live in an area that is extremely hostile against Christianity as a whole. I mean, they got all kinds of problems against their church. They picketed the church before. And it's a whole bunch of different issues. And then on top of that, they've got a pastor who grew up being born under communist Russia. So he has lived in a domain and in a government in which all your rights are trampled on, ruined, destroyed, et cetera, et cetera. And when all the mandates started coming on their church there in the Boston area, you can well imagine he had some deep concerns about religious liberty. Very deep concerns. But he also knew this. I'm not in Russia. My context right now is I am in Boston, Massachusetts, of the United States of America. And as a result, we are under intense scrutiny for everything. I mean, LGBTQ issues, we don't approve and condone that. So the culture hates us for that. And when it comes to, you know, the different roles for men and women, we're holding to a biblical view, and the culture hates us for that. But I think the biggest one is, as a church, they say there's only one way to God. And how's that? Through Jesus Christ alone. And the culture hates them for that. And so as they're thinking through what is it that we're going to do, rather than try and express their religious independence and their American liberties, they knew that defiance against a mandate would unnecessarily injure their witness and shut down the message of the gospel in the area in which God had placed them. And they knew when this whole thing is over, and eventually it will be, are we going to have a message that we can share, or are we going to have invalidated it by the way we handled ourselves? So what did they do? They complied. They complied with everything that the government required of them, and their attitude was the gospel's reputation is greater than anything else that we can stand for right now. And the mandates are not moral issues demanding we acquiesce to something that is not true. We'll be patient, and we figure we'll let the courts rule, and we'll wait and see what God does in and through that. But it was a tough call. Now I'm picking on one church, but that was across the entire United States. And it was a struggle. It was a struggle. Can I bring all this together, maybe with an illustration that is a little bit more inspiring and maybe a little bit helpful? Most of you I know have played baseball, all right? Karen and I, we live right next door to the baseball field, and all these little kids come out and play. Sometimes we'll go over there and watch it. But if you've ever played baseball, you know one of the greatest feelings there is when you're playing, when you actually not just get on first base, but you actually make it all the way around and you get to cross home plate. Is that not wonderful? You feel like, I've contributed. I accomplished. I overcame the hurdles and the obstacles, and my teammates helped me, and we finally got me all the way here. But every once in a while, because baseball is a game of strategy, a coach will look at a player and says, your job is not to get on the plate. We got a guy on third base over here. Your job is to hit the ball just as far away as you possibly can into right field. And as you put the ball out there, you're going to free up our third base guy to be able to run and to get in the home and score us some points. The term is called a sacrifice fly. How do you get, and I'll say in particular, any male to willingly surrender his chance to surround the bases? I mean, to forsake that moment of glory. How are you going to do it? It's really simple. You reward them with a statistic. And what baseball did, came out, was brilliant. They said every time you have to give up going to the base to get somebody else in, the stat is what? RBI. Runs batted in. So everyone knows you surrendered your chance to get on there, but you did it because it wasn't about you. You were going to get this one on third base. You were going to bring them into home and get them there unhindered. Why? Because you're looking for the team. We are more important than me. When we get to heaven, there is a time where there will be rewards that are given. And I wonder if one of the rewards will be an SBI, souls batted in. People that came in, because there's a recognition that the gospel was actually propelled when you sacrificed something. You gave up something, maybe particularly to an authority, and you removed unnecessary hurdles such that they could see who God is and make their way into heaven, and they didn't even have to slide home. They could just walk right on in because you were faithful. Ladies and gentlemen, there are going to be times where Jesus is going to call you to consider the authorities in your life. It may be a teacher, it may be a governmental office, it may be a parent, it might be a policeman. I don't know, but there's going to be somebody somewhere. And you're going to potentially have to sacrifice a freedom or a liberty. And in doing so, God's going to use it to advance the mission of the gospel. And your flesh is going to bow up, fight against this kind of humility with everything in it. It's going to hate it because it means you're having to die to yourself. But when you do that, when we do, God will use it. And who knows what kind of score will come in because you were faithful in humility to surrender those rights, those opportunities, because the gospel is more important than me. Our model is Jesus. And let me read this. This is what we're to do. Have this attitude in yourselves, which was also in Christ Jesus, who, although he existed in the form of God, did not regard equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself, taking the form of a bondservant and being made in the likeness of men, being found in the appearance as a man. And he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. And for this reason also, God highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name which is above every name, so that at the name of Jesus, every knee will bow, of those who are in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. Would you bow with me? Father, I just come before you admittedly confessing I don't like to submit. I like to think that I'm in control. I like to establish what I want to establish, and I don't have a heart that quickly yields in humility, and it's because I'm proud, and I don't think I'm the only one. So, Lord, as a people, what we want to do is we do really want to surrender ourselves to you, to be ready to go where you say go, to take up any order and command that you would give. But we'll just confess, the hardest command you give us sometimes is surrender, and we hate it until we recognize that if that's your command, then it is good, and it will ultimately be wonderful. And Jesus is our best example. We're so grateful, Lord, that he didn't demand his rights to come down from the cross. We're so thankful, Lord, that he didn't demand that the angels come and rescue him so that he would not have to pay our price. And Lord, would you just help us to be a people to have the wisdom to know what to lay down and when to lay it down. And in the meantime, God, we do want to be a people that live in the tremendous freedom that we've been given. And there is so much that we have been given. So, Father, use your word by the power of your Spirit. Use the community of believers to help us, to shepherd us, to guide us whenever we are faced with these difficulties, to know when to say no and when to create offense and when to remove something so as not to create an offense. And God, we will pray and ask it in the name of Jesus. Amen. Let's stand as Anna and the team lead us in worship.